The floods that have wreaked havoc up the East Coast the last few weeks are yet another reminder of the effect that climate change is already having on our planet and the far worse to come. 3 are confirmed dead and 18,000 have been forced to evacuate. For every degree of warming, extreme weather events like these will grow more frequent or more severe. More and more, our climate shifts into a vacillation between extremes. Just over a year ago, we were getting familiar with a different kind of mask as Australia entered the decade under smoke and fire. After a year in which hundreds of thousands mobilised across the country demanding action on climate change, our fears tore down on us, blasted up the East Coast, tore down 3,000 homes, killed a billion animals, killed 33 people, or almost 500 once you include those killed not directly by the fire, but by the smoke that blanketed cities for weeks. Around the world, the picture isn't much better. Wildfires in the Arctic Circle, in California, in India, Indonesia, the Amazon rainforest turning to savanna, Tuvalu sinking beneath the ocean, floods in Jakarta, floods, droughts, salinization in Bangladesh. Climate change will kill an additional 250,000 people per year between 2030 and 2050 from malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress. Already, 1 in 5 deaths across the globe are caused by the pollution from fossil fuels. 8.7 million people killed every year by this industry. Catastrophic and unprecedented. The two words used everywhere to describe the Black Summer bushfires are writ large across the planet. So over recent years, there's been a marked shift in the political terrain. Green capitalism, rather than climate denialism, has become the prevailing response of the establishment. So on the one hand, politicians who once flaunted lumps of coal in Parliament now take up net zero emissions by 2050 targets. Such progressive institutions as Shell, ExxonMobil and the US military describe the climate crisis as a real and serious threat. Bodies from local councils to the EU declare climate emergencies, investments in renewables are at a record high, and Biden, the leader of the US empire, is vaunted for his radical or even revolutionary climate plan. But on the other hand, the fossil fuel industry continues to expand. According to the UN, the production of fossil fuels needs to drop 6% annually for the next 10 years to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. Despite this, and despite global agreements dating back to the 80s, we're on the opposite trajectory. The production of fossil fuels is increasing yearly by 2%. Investment in renewables may be rising, but the production of coal, gas and oil are at or near record levels. For 40 years, we've had goals, ambitions, agreements, words and yet more words as emissions continue to rise and rise. Too long has the mainstream climate movement treated these as victories, which makes it all the more important that we have a clear answer to the question, what the fuck are we going to do about this? And that question is contested. Depending on what you believe is driving the climate crisis, you might believe it's anything from protesting on the streets to investing in Future Super, riding a bike, or riding your local MP. Or even nothing at all. Indeed, the establishment's answer to what the masses of ordinary people have to do about the climate crisis has changed from the nothing at all of the climate crisis doesn't exist to the nothing at all of capitalism is going to sort it out. Well, the situation remains fundamentally the same, and the smoke of the Black Summer bushfire should hang over everything that's gone since. Every new coal mine, every new gas and oil project. Net zero emissions by 2050 is the new climate denialism. And the headlines of Biden's and Morrison's and Albanese's green ambitions should be read under the bushfire's apocalyptic glow. Under such a light, I'm going to argue that they cannot measure up to the crisis that we're facing, and instead function to convince us that we can deal with climate change without system change. And I'm going to argue that those who form government, those who seek to run capitalism, with whether they be the Democrats, Labor, or even the Greens, will not only be incapable of providing such change, but will be compelled in government to be staunch opponents of it in action. I'll argue that Marxism is the only theory that can not only explain the climate crisis, but also point the way to overcoming it. And I'll show how the two central features of capitalism, that it's a system that's class divided and a system driven by competition for profit, explain why it's capitalism that is responsible for destroying the planet, and that if we are to build a world in which people aren't left aren't left to be poisoned to death by gas and smoke or have their homes swallowed by fire and flood, then we need a worldwide revolution to wrest power from the capitalists. The first feature of capitalism is that it's class divided. And when Marxists talk about class, we're not talking about your culture or your income level or anything like that. We're talking concretely about your relationship to production. Are you someone who works for a wage or someone who profits off the labour of others? Do you stack shelves or own the supermarket? Are you a nurse in a hospital or do you sit on its board? Do you work in a coal mine or can you sit at home earning 12 grand every 3 minutes as Gina Reinhart does? Our class has a definitive effect on how we experience the world. Our bosses can decide whether we can put food on the table, whether we're out on the street, and using that coercive power, they can decide whether we live lives of dignity or are degraded and abused. They can decide whether our workplaces are safe, whether our health and well-being or even our lives are risked for their profits. For example, the conditions in Australian coal mines today are so bad that there's been a resurgence of an incurable disease called black lung, caused by the inhalation of coal dust. It's an 1800s disease that literally turns your lungs black. At its worst, it kills people or makes them permanently reliant on a respirator to breathe. So what are Gina Reinhart's chances of contracting black lung? I think we can say pretty confidently that they're nil. Likewise, what are Gordon Madani's chances of dying from a hot water pipeline burst at one of his coal-fired power stations? Well, that's what happened to 7 of his workers in 2016. Those are just a couple examples of the countless instances of death, disease, and maiming that occur under these bosses. And if the everyday functioning of capitalism is bad, crisis ratchets these antagonisms up to an extreme. Class becomes the delineator that determines how you experience climate change. So during the Black Summer bushfires, construction of luxury apartments continued under red skies, with workers forced to continue to labour in toxic bushfire smoke. People were forced to use annual leave or else head into work, even as Sydney recorded the most toxic air on the planet. Just as with the pandemic, the rich who profit from the poison can simply stay at home. Their labour does not make the world go round, nor is it responsible for their wealth. What's more, while wildfires present as some of the most explosive effects of climate change, extreme heat is going to become a lethal and debilitating reality for a good half of the world's population. So 0.8% of the global landmass currently experiences Sahara desert-like heat with temperatures averaging above 29 degrees Celsius. By 2070, those conditions will have extended to 19% of all land. And while the rich and powerful can expect to luxuriate in air-conditioned palaces like Mukesh Ambani's or have their mansions defended by private firefighting forces like Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, 3.5 billion people will be threatened with conditions that are virtually uninhabitable. And what can those who migrate expect to face under capitalism? Militarised borders, concentration camps, and indefinite detention without end, as Australia's border regime today demonstrates. While at the same time, the rich can apply for visas here by investing just $5 million. As far as the boss is concerned, borders only exist for their workers, and they exist as a weapon against their workers, such as the 457 visas bosses use to force their international labour to work under barbaric conditions with pittance for wages by threatening them with deportation. So contrary to the claim made by sections of the climate movement that we're all in this together, I think we can say it's pretty clear that we're not. There is a line drawn between two camps that in crisis only grows clearer. On the one side, you have the bosses and their lackeys in government. And on the other, you have the working class. We have an interest in fighting capitalism, its borders, our exploitation, and the climate change caused by it. And the bosses, the capitalists, have an interest in upholding every one of these injustices. Their industries threaten our lives in the day-to-day and the conditions of our existence in the long term, and they can expect to avoid the worst effects while they reap all the benefits. So all of this goes to say the bosses don't have an interest in ending environmental destruction like workers do. But what do their profits have to do with the climate crisis? Why is ecological destruction the order of the day for them? The answer strikes at the black heart of capitalism. So capitalists need to constantly expand their profits to stay ahead of their rivals. If they fail to do so, they won't have the capital to invest in new technology or opening markets. When that opportunity comes, their rivals will outmatch them and push them out of business. So remaining in that game means operating on this ruthless competitive logic. Capitalists need to keep their net profits high by keeping their costs as low as possible. The main way they do that is by pushing workers to increase their productivity while continuing to suppress their wages. But it also means taking every other advantage to cut costs. I've spoken about the dangers that capitalists put their workers' lives in instead of investing in safety measures, but pollution and waste are other examples of this. Cleaning up waste or using non-polluting technologies is almost always more expensive or less profitable. Instead, these costs are treated as externalities that can be passed on to the environment and communities. So far I've been talking about the climate crisis as if fossil fuels are the only question at issue, but they're only a single dimension of a much broader crisis. Looking at capitalist production generally, we see that competition is driving climate and ecological destruction on every front, crises that interact with and reinforce each other. So take agriculture, for example. According to the IPCC, it's responsible for between 21 and 37% of all carbon emissions. And for 80% of tropical deforestation. But that's not all. One of the key ways that capitalist agriculture is destroying the planet is the runoff of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers into the ocean. These fertilizers are relied upon to replenish soil nutrients and the food that we eat, but the fertilizers are dispensed liberally and imprecisely, and less than 20% of the nitrogen actually ends up where it's meant to be in human food. When the rain comes, the fertilizers are washed into irrigation, into streams and rivers, and eventually into lakes or the sea. There, the runoff, along with sewage, contributes to algal blooms that create dead zones in the water, sections that have little or no oxygen, sections incapable of supporting life. As of 2008, these dead zones covered 245,000 square kilometres of the ocean, spreading up coastlines across the planet, and they continue to grow. This isn't an inevitable result of human life or population size. There are a number of ways that this runoff could be reduced, but agribusiness has successfully resisted regulation. They've made their own analysis that it's cheaper to waste and pollute rather than to invest in managing their crops in a more controlled way. So combined with the ocean's acidification and warming and the depletion of fish stocks because of fishing trawlers, this process is threatening a key food source relied upon by billions of people. There are far more examples of ways that capitalism is destroying the planet that I can talk about in any detail. There's deforestation, there's the pesticide necessitated by monoculture crops, which is contributing to the deaths of 40% of all insect species. There's plant obsolescence, industrial feedlots, which are a breeding ground for diseases, the wastage of a third of all food through the production line, there's the fishing trawlers that waste 35% of the food they catch, and so on and so forth. And there's the destruction of ancient Aboriginal cultural sites, like the Jabiroong birthing trees or the Jumpin Gorge cave, which was blown up by Rio Tinto. At every point, capitalism necessarily creates overproduction, waste and destruction. But does all of this mean that capitalism can't go green? Daily, the media reports on new innovations, breakthroughs and records broken like a broken record. Some of this is hyperbole, some of it is spin, and some of it is creative accounting. One example is the negative emissions through which the Australian government can continue to claim to be meeting its emission reductions targets while also expanding the fossil fuel industry. Basically, they pay farmers not to clear forests and then claim that the forest's continued existence offsets fossil fuel use, which is a bit like claiming that you killed no one because you said you'd kill two people and then you only killed one, thereby saving the other and bringing your net murders to zero. Net zero by 2050. But the issue is not that change isn't happening. There are some developments. Investment in renewables reached $282 billion in 2019. The largest car manufacturers like Toyota, Volkswagen and General Motors all have plans to make a substantial or majority part of their sales up from electric vehicles within the next couple decades. And the two biggest steel producing companies in the world are close to putting green or low carbon steel on the market. However, the scale of such developments is massively overstated, or else emissions wouldn't be continuing to rise. And the nature of these profit-driven innovations makes them environmentally destructive in other ways. It's on these points that green capitalism proves to be a farce. So first on scale, as I indicated earlier, investment in renewables hit a record high in 2019, but this still represents only 15% of the $1.8 trillion invested yearly in energy. And in the same year, coal, oil and gas had all reached record levels and are continuing to grow. This is possible because global energy capacity continues to increase, and also because fossil fuels are integral to much more of the economy than just the spheres that renewables are competing with them in. So fossil fuels are deeply entrenched in all areas of industry. I mentioned before that there have been some developments in green steel. The conventional production of iron and steel relies on blast furnaces and the burning of coke from metallurgical coal. A process that accounts for the production of steel being the greatest single contributor to carbon emissions of any industry, an industry now worth over $2.5 trillion. Innovations may make green steel possible, but as the Financial Times points out, overhauling a monolithic and slow-moving smokestack industry that churns out 2 billion tonnes of steel every year is an enormous task that could require investments of hundreds of billions of dollars, not an investment you just opt to make when your main concern is your bottom line. And the scale of the global economic transformation doesn't end with steel. Fossil fuels are relied upon by aviation and the production of synthetic fertilisers, concrete and plastics. And in addition to the commodities that are specifically reliant on them, as Andreas Malm puts it in Fossil Capital, fossil fuels are utilised across the spectrum of commodity production as the material that sets it all into physical motion. These production processes have infrastructure that are dependent on or tailored to fossil fuels. And their artefacts, roads, trucks, airports, cargo ships, machines with oil engines, factories with coal furnaces, entire towns and power grids set up around coal pits. Excising the global economy's dependence on fossil fuels means completely restructuring production chains. All of these industries are run for profit. The immense overheads involved in reconstituting the entire economy at the scale and the pace necessary to deal with the climate crisis is inconceivable under the impetus of profit-driven competition. Then in terms of the nature of these developments, another important dimension of such changes is that the competitive drive for profit doesn't end with fossil fuel use. The fact that personal electric vehicles even constitute a central feature of the plans of the EU, the US and China is a symptom of this. It's far more profitable to sell cars as individual personal products than to invest in collectivised transport. But electrifying all cars and vans just in the UK would take just under the entire planet's yearly production of a number of rare minerals for a country with just 0.89% of the global population. So electrifying the globe's electric vehicles would require such an upscaling of production that would result both in a massive increase of mining in regions like Latin America, which would necessarily involve environmental destruction and a massive and murderous campaign waged against those who would justly resist it, and such a reliance on fossil fuels for mining, shipping and manufacturing that would likely render the electrification self-defeating. In other words, while the forms of environmental destruction may change under capitalism, the fact of it does not. So the short-termism of competition for profit means that capitalists are unable to resolve the climate crisis. If that's the case, is it finally up to us to do something about it, or is there another social force that we can rely on? Well, whether or not they talk about protests as having a role in such change, many would argue that the right people in government, whether they be AOC, Corbyn or Adam Bandt, would be able to introduce regulations to fix these problems. But this is as much a dead end as relying on the capitalists to introduce these changes themselves. It comes down to two issues. The first is the role of international competition, and then more fundamentally, the question of who holds power in society. So first of all, international competition. In the same way that capitalist firms are forced to compete or else be put out of business, so does competition extend into the rivalry between capitalist states. If a state doesn't use all of its means to foster local capital, its businesses, its economy, i.e. profitability for the bosses, then it will be more and more subordinated to the powers of other capitalist states, economically or militarily. Military competition also makes fossil fuel use absolutely indispensable to state power, oil in particular. So the US military, for instance, produces more emissions than 140 countries just by its use of fuel. Without considering the massive amount of resources burnt and consumed in the production of steels for arms and armor. So war isn't about to go green, least of all the tanks and bombers and aircraft carriers. And so dismantling these war machines becomes necessary for a green transition. Not something I doubt anyone here is going to be disappointed by. I doubt anyone here owns bombers or tanks. But it's also not something that's about to happen under capitalism. Even a slight check on military power becomes all the more unimaginable as imperialist tensions ratchet up around the world. So secondly is the question of who actually holds power in society. So it can seem obvious to nearly anyone that you talk to on the street that it's the rich who rule, but besides the overt and covert bribery, besides the revolving door between parliament and industry, and besides everything else that weds politicians to the will of capital, there is a far more profound power that capitalists hold, which means that no matter what anti-corruption commissions take place and regulations take place, and no matter how left-wing the party in power, the capitalists are still in complete control. That is to say, their economic power. So they have complete dictatorial control over what gets produced, how, and for whom. And they have control over where they invest. And this is a key power that capitalists can threaten against any government that acts against their interests. Do this, and we will pack up our capital, invest elsewhere, and crash your economy. Not something that any political party interested in their own survival is going to be willing to risk. So these features of capitalism are the reason it's so profoundly undemocratic. They make sense of why it doesn't matter that the vast majority of people want action on climate change, that only 12% of people supported a gas-led recovery. International competition means that governments are compelled by basically the same forces that capitalist firms are. And where they act against such interests, they would be quickly reminded of who really holds power. So you can look at the details of this or that Green New Deal or Green Plan, and many of the particulars may be supportable, but this misses the point, which is a question of power. Who is it that rules under capitalism, and who is it that has the potential to challenge such a rule? For this, we have to turn back and ask not who runs the world, but who makes the world run. Who is it that builds the military's tanks and bombers? Who is it that runs the gas-fired power stations? Who is it that builds the cars and the batteries? Who is it that's forced to clear the forests, run the harvesters, and prep the soil? The same people who choke on bushfire smoke, who develop black lung, who die under the bombs, who are poisoned in the cities. The working class. And just as the capitalists, under the forces of competition, concentrate the workers, put them into collaboration in greater and greater production chains across the planet, so do they produce, as Marx puts it, their own grave diggers. So workers, being responsible for the boss's profits, can just as easily put an end to them by withdrawing their labour. This tool, the strike, can be used to fight for basic conditions, wage rises, dignity on the job, refusing to work in bushfire smoke. But as workers begin to have a sense of their own power, they can use it in other ways too. This is what the Radical Builders Labourers Federation did in the 70s in Australia, when after building up rank and file union strength around the basic issues I described, they started to make calls about what else would go on. We'll refuse to tear down this working class community. We'll refuse to develop on this native bushland. In the words of militant Jack Mundy, though we want all our members to be employed, we will not just become robots directed by developer builders who value the dollar at the expense of the environment. More and more, we are going to determine which buildings we will build. And there is no shortage of such movements all throughout history when crisis and struggle have pushed the shelf stackers, the coal miners, the textile workers to look around and think, oh shit, we're actually the ones who make the world run. Just as capitalism's inevitable crises ratchet up class antagonisms to the extreme, so too do they make the line clearer between the Gina Reinhardts and the Gorda Madanis and all the rest of us around the world. Australia has no shortage of such radical struggles, whether we're talking about Aboriginal resistance against invasion or struggles against developments, coal mines, uranium mines. But the question of the fight for climate justice is not really a question of where the slogans of the climate are raised. The militant rank and file of the Builders Labourers Federation built their strength under the pressures of the struggle against the Vietnam War. They observed the students' tactics, were inspired by the radicalism all around the world, and they took this into bread and butter issues before they took up broader questions. This is not to say that a resurgence of such radicalism here will follow the same course, but instead to say that anywhere in the world that there is a fight against oppression or injustice, there are people that are fighting against the very same system that is destroying the planet. There are people that are occupying the streets and their workplaces and for the first time in their lives having a sense of their own power. So at this very moment, a heroic struggle is taking place in Myanmar, where the working class are rebelling against a brutal coup and the military establishment that have terrorised them for decades. Workers have paralysed the economy, shutting down oil refineries, mines, hospitals, large farms, shipyards, banks and textile factories. Every day they are demonstrating immense courage and, more importantly, the immense power that the working class can wield. If a militant radical working class were to consolidate from this struggle, it would be a far greater development for the climate movement than any green program in parliament, for the simple reason that this question is about power, the power of our side. The climate crisis cannot be dealt with short of destroying capitalism, and capitalism cannot be destroyed short of an international working class revolution in which the vast majority of people seize power and found society anew in the interests of humanity. So 2 years ago, a few months before I became a member of Socialist Alternative, I came to a session on the climate like this at Marx's in 2019. And in the discussion, I asked, well, I agree with all this, but what do we actually do about it? And this is basically the question that I've been trying to get at. Capitalism is a system driven by ruthless competition for profit, and the competition between capitalist firms and the international competition between states prevents both boards and governments from ending environmental destruction generally. It also prevents them from transitioning from fossil fuels at the scale and pace necessary to deal with the climate crisis. But at every point where this destruction occurs, there is a class that has both the interest in and the power to end the fossil fuel use and end environmental destruction. A class, yes, divided by racism and sexism and convinced from birth that ordinary people can't run the world. That's done by specialists. It's done by politicians. It's done by the big men of history, not ordinary people. And there is no international working class movement today capable of overthrowing capitalism. So then the what we do can be reframed as how do we get there? And history proves that time and time again, the possibility to create such a movement will present itself, as it did in Sudan, as I asked that question, as it did thereafter in Lebanon, in Chile, in Hong Kong, in Belarus, in Thailand, in Black Lives Matter, the largest social movement in US history. Just last year, as it does today in Myanmar. In every one of these movements, every movement against oppression and injustice that draws people out onto the streets for the first time, people begin to learn lessons that prove the opposite. We have more in common with the oppressed and exploited all over the world than we could ever have with Scott Morrison and Gina Rinehart. And we learn that contrary to what's drilled into us from day one, that ordinary people can make history. So the role of socialists today is to build every one of these struggles, to build the climate movement, yes, but also to fight for refugee rights, to fight against black deaths in custody, to fight against sexist shits like Christian Porter, and to build the forces of the revolutionary left who can help to push every one of these struggles forward. This conference is a part of that, as is everything else Socialist Alternative does, every protest we organise, every campaign we create. So we've been waiting 40 years for a green transition. 2050 is just another way of kicking the can down the road. And when you start to think about what a green transition would mean, it becomes pretty clear why people might want to do that. So dealing with the climate crisis means, practically, that in every factory, every power station, every industrial farm, every transport firm, every commercial fishing company, workers need to take power and begin to run workplaces democratically, to radically transform society in the interests of human need, not the profits of a tiny few. Such a transformation cannot be achieved by any number of green programs doled out from on high. The majority of humanity have to truly believe and prove to ourselves through struggle of the kind going on in Myanmar right now, that we can run the world. That starts with mass movements in the streets, and it ends when society has been democratized from bottom to top, from mine to factory and farm to supermarket, and when the people who plunder the world have been run out of it and the masses of ordinary people have taken power across it. And that means nothing short of revolution.